Next, we have a panel discussion with Q&A moderated by Cecilia Hellestveit. Hellestveit is a lawyer and social scientist with a PhD in international humanitarian law from the University of Oslo. She has been associated with a number of research institutes in Norway and abroad, and is a board member of the Refugee Council. Hellestveit researches and teaches in the field of international law, use of force, and armed conflicts. She is also a columnist for several Norwegian newspapers and has also published a book on Syria entitled A Great War in a Small World.
So, thank you very much for excellent introductions and presentations. Now, the subject of our conversation is jihadist growth after the Arab Spring. On Monday, we have the 15th of March, which is basically 10 years after the Syrian, the main day of the Syrian Arab Spring. And on the 18th of March is the day of the start of the Yemeni Arab Spring. Now, both of those countries did not survive the transition at all. But we have been speaking mostly about the African Sahel and European effects of the Arab Spring that basically started in the Middle East. Now, we're not really going to talk that much about the Middle East. We're going to talk about the kind of reverberations that they've had elsewhere. I just wanted to start by picking up the introductions on the Sahel region, because the impression over the last years has been that this is where jihadists are still having their day. Now, to what extent is there a Sahelian exception? You have been touching upon this in your presentations, but the overall view, is it the fact that the wars in the Middle East have kind of put the jihadist movements, both ISIL, the Caliphate, and Al-Qaeda in a box, in a way, and that Africa is where expansion is possible? Is that what you also see? Because I can hear quite a lot of things in your introduction, such that this is a propaganda as well, entertainment from ISIS. They do not really have a lot of Europeans in their ranks. And you also mentioned, Morten, that you do not see that these movements will represent true threats to state apparatuses in Africa as long as they have support from the outside. So to what extent is this reality that that these movements are having a great day in Africa?
If I may?
Yes.
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, the jihad, the various jihadi insurgencies in the Sahel, that is in Mali, Niger, Burkina, mainly, they are having a field day. I mean, they are on the offensive right now. But they are a very local groups. And that is their strength, but also their weakness. And that ties into this thing about the Sahelian exception, whether it exists or not. And there are two sort of dimensions to this Sahelian exception. One is that this is the exception because this is where they are expanding. The second one was this idea that there was a Sahelian exception because here there were cordial relationships between groups that formally claimed that they belonged to ISIS and groups that formally claimed that they belonged or had a relationship to Al-Qaeda. My research seemed to indicate that the fight that started, that Vidar rightly pointed out, that started last year or sort of towards the end of 2019, that would have happened anyway, because there was no way. If you look at how they have built their local alliances, how they've integrated locally, this was bound to clash, because they integrate locally by appropriating local conflict lines. And that is a huge, it's a very powerful tool to integrate locally, but it also means that you're taking the side in local conflicts. So yes, you create friends by doing this, but you also create enemies by doing this. And what really set this off in central Mali was basically a ruling in the Shura Council of one local group that belongs to Denim, that is the Katiba Mazina. And the Shura Council here was ruling on who should have privileged access to the resources of the Inner Delta, where this is going. The Inner Delta is the tribute rivers to the river Niger. And the Shura Council basically ruled not on an Umma principle, but on an autochthony principle, basically saying that the ones that should have privileged access to resources are the people who are born here. An autochthony ruling. And of course, that meant that a lot of people started looking at it, what the hell am I doing here? Why am I fighting for this group if I don't get anything out of it? And then they moved to ISTS. And that did not go very well down with the leadership, nor with local supporters of the Katiba Mazina. So this was bound to start clashing. And if you look at how they have built up their alliances, they're going to struggle to keep the whole Drenim structure together, in my point of view. And we have seen this also before in the Sahel, that it builds up to a certain level and then it starts fragmenting again. I think this will happen again. That said, just 10 seconds. Yes, this is where they're expanding right now, but I would not be, I'm not completely certain that there is not a room for expansion once more in Syria and Iraq as well. There are things happening on the ground that may suggest a build-up of a reformed ISIS, for example, in the borderlands between Syria and Iraq.
Yeah, we might come back to the Middle East afterwards, but I just want to stick with the African. So if I read you correctly, these movements, they appropriate the local conflicts, they exploit the cleavages, and then they own the local conflicts, and they get all those problems in addition, and you have this kind of linkage. So to what extent do you agree with this analysis?
Well, I agree with a lot of it.
We are very much looking for the differences.
Well, so when it comes to this Sahelian exception between IS and JNIM, it's I don't think it came as a big surprise to a lot of people that fighting eventually broke out, but I think on a broader scale, if you see in other conflict theaters as well, the fact that ISGS had for a long time been the junior partner, where so JNIM used to be by far the biggest group and the biggest threat in the Sahel, and I think as long as they had as long as ISGS was the junior partner, they managed to, if not cooperate, at least leave each other alone in order to focus on the shared enemy, the shared local enemy, and the shared and also against the French. But I do also think that there are that. You can also see that the ideological differences have been played up at the same time as, I mean, there are, of course, local power struggles are definitely also part of this, but you have seen, as these two groups have clashed, you've seen that that ISGS has become, let's say, more IS and kind of try to purify this Islamic State ideology. While JNIM has done the opposite. So over the course of this conflict, you have seen the two camps coalesce more clearly.
Can I ask you a question? Because when we talk about the rise of the caliphate in Syria and Iraq, one of the things that it had was that a number of the medium level and top level leaders, they came from the Iraqi state. So they knew how to run a state. And they had populations that knew how a brutal state could operate. So there was this recognition that may enable the caliphate to establish itself in that particular historical context. Now, is this also a part of the explanation why this type of model that the caliphate established, that you can take this model that we have now created, you can import it into all of these other countries, and you can establish wilayas with these structures. Why hasn't this really worked? Has it also to do with the lack of people, the entrepreneurs that Petra also talked about? Is that also one of the explanations why ISIL has changed character in a way in Africa compared to what it was, at least, in Iraq and Syria?
Well, if I may, I mean, I think that any insurgency that has any chance of succeeding and success here mainly means staying alive, right? Because these are asymmetrical warfare, needs to adapt to the territory. And it was much easier to establish a caliphate with state-like structures in a place like Iraq or Syria than it is here. I mean, you need resources, you need cities, you need infrastructure. I mean, in the case of Iraq and Syria, there was resources, institutions, a lot of things that you basically could take over. That really doesn't exist here, apart from the capitals. That said, I mean, it's interesting to see that those that I know perhaps gaining some traction as the more pragmatic part of Al-Qaeda, if you can talk about such a thing. Who are they in the case of the Sahel? Well, these are the older generation. These are people who have had connections to government in the past. In fact, I mean, the leader here, Iyad Aghali, which is the key person in Jenim, I mean, he has had a number of also government functions in the past, including being attached to the Malian embassy in Saudi Arabia. And he has negotiated in the past. Al-Shorawi, which is the leader of the Islamic State, the Greater Sahara. Well, I mean, he's a runaway from the Polisario camps in Algeria. I mean, he doesn't have anything to gain, really, from negotiations. Aghali still has at least the possibility of negotiating something for himself as well.
One thing that I noticed, you talked about the absence of foreign fighters in the Sahel area. Now, one very important military actor is France. So, and a lot of French people are elsewhere. In the Middle East, we find people from France. How do you explain that there is not a closer link between these movements in Sahel and radical Islamist environments in Europe or in France? What is the explanation for that? It struck me when I was listening to you there is a missing link. How do you explain this? Can I talk to you first, and then I'll leave the word to Vida afterwards?
Yeah, that's one of the big questions we are pondering about, the relative absence of European or Western foreign fighters Northern Africa and the Sahel region as well. If you compare to other theaters like in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where we had many foreign fighters going, and the Middle East, I haven't really found the the explanation. I don't know. It may have there's the language factor, which is one thing,
and when you say the language factor, you say Arabic or French?
Of course, you have a French language in most of these regions. So for the French, it could be, but also this is a region where French have intelligence, right, and cooperation with all the states. So the movement across borders could be harder for people coming from France. And then there have been alternative and more attractive locations, right, as we had with the caliphate in the heart of the Middle East, which had a major symbolic value for these groups. But it just struck me when we were discussing now, it's been 10 years since the Arab Spring, we are seeing still a highly almost a formidable insurgency and terrorist actor operating across the world, all regions, and what I draw from the presentation is this mobility, you know, adaptability, the pragmatism, basically. These movements manage to operate in some way or form in open democracies in Europe, in you know, weak states in Africa, in authoritarian, very hard or hardcore states, you know, in such as now in the Middle East and North Africa. So it's just basically worrying and fascinating that we still see mobilization and also, you know, signs of a comeback in the hard areas in Syria and Iraq.
Now, I just wanted to have your comment on the lacking link between Europe, and then I will. Yeah.
Now, I'd just like to qualify what I said about the foreign fighters. So there are foreign fighters in the Sahel, but there are very few foreign fighters from the West. So Sahrawi, for instance, that you mentioned, is from West Sahara. A lot of the leading figures in the Sahelian jihadist scene have been North Africans. But there are very few foreign fighters from the West. Even there have been some, but there are very few. I've also been thinking about this, like why is Mali not an attractive place to go? I mean, on paper at least, it has a lot of the qualities that would make it a great spot for foreign fighters. It's they established an Islamic State if you look at Northern Mali 2012 2013, and then there was a Western intervention and occupation of Muslim lands. One reason is probably what Petter said, that there were better places to go or more attractive places to go. But I also have the impression that the whole, at least in 2012, 2013, what was happening in Mali was not very well known in the West, even among prospective foreign fighters. So you can see on jihadist forums at the time that they had open, like, question and answer sessions with people in that they were connected to the Islamic State in Azawad, and people were asking, like, who are you guys? What is Ansar al-Din? Where did you come from? Are you jihadists? So people didn't really know, and I think it was, and just to follow up on what you said about the caliphate in Iraq and Syria and differences. It was quite easy to get to Syria. You could take a plane to Turkey and just cross the border, whereas getting to Mali was harder.
And I also think,
I just want to follow up because it also, of course, has to do with the links from the networks in the West and the conflict zones, because you need kind of a critical mass of people to get a recruitment route up going, right? So it often has to do with some, you know, influential entrepreneur making the journey, getting those local contacts, and sometimes they just happen to have the right contacts in one region and just don't in another, right? So, and there are a lot of coincidences as well that plays into this.
Yeah, coincidences, but also, I mean, one thing is that it's much more difficult to get there. I mean, here you would need to fly into Mali, and then you would need to start a long and difficult and dangerous journey to get to the areas where these people are. And whereas, I mean, the Caliphate and ISIS, I mean, they could sort of advertise with housing, swimming pools, and a lush life. I mean, what you get here is an immensely hard life. I mean, we have talked, we have interviewed people who have been fighting with these groups and left them. So the main reason why they left is that life in the bush is so hard. So I don't think that many of wannabe jihadists in Europe is really cut for this type of life. And in addition, I mean, if somebody should, in fact get this idea of I want to travel to Mali and join Denim. I mean, there's chance that they would, if two, three people emerge out of the blue somewhere where Denim are, I mean, they would be highly suspicious and most likely they would kill them or take them or capture them and take them as hostages instead, because they wouldn't really understand why somebody would travel from, let's say, Norway to Mali to fight for them. The whole idea would seem unimaginable.
But you had a lot of foreign fighters going to Afghanistan and to Waziristan and places like that where living conditions are bad as well. So,
but that was also a situation where you have very good entrepreneurs, I would suggest.
And networks built up over time, yeah.
But one of the things that the caliphate offered was a closeness to the narratives of the scripture. Because, I mean, these are people who follow, they are religious, they follow a scriptural interpretation of the Quran and the Hadith. And in Syria and in Iraq, you find the geographical areas, you find the Yazidis and Hadith, and so ISIL could, or the Caliphate could kind of take advantage of these things. This is where it is happening. This is the kind of the rebirth of the Caliphate, and that is of course difficult to do outside of the very heart of the Middle East. So does that mean that this is kind of the spider in the web to some extent, that it goes via the heart of the Middle East to?
And you need to produce text.
You need to produce text.
And these groups, by and large, with one exception, and that's the Nigerian Islamic State West Africa province, they produce a lot of text. It's just that it's so dense that nobody's actually able to read it. I mean, they are producing text en masse, but if you look at those that are most active in the Sahelian territories, it's almost nil that they produce of text. I mean, the Katiba Masina produce quite a lot of scriptures that are circulated on cell phones and flashes and so on of Kufa, but Kufa mainly talk about very local issues. So it's, if anybody sort of a wannabe traveler in Europe, if he or she got access to one of Kufa's preachings or sermons, I mean, wouldn't understand anything of it because it evolves around such local issues. And without that kind of textual and visual presentation of something that is larger than the local struggle, I think they would really struggle to attract foreign fighters, at least in my point of view. That may change, of course.
I think the proto-states in other areas are kind of stops on the road to Jerusalem, right? It's, I mean, you the symbolical value of Syria, Iraq is something that always will. That's where they will focus all their power, basically.
And Mecca and Medina.
Of course.
Now, to return to this issue of the Arab Spring, because this is the 10th anniversary, and although this existed far before the Arab Spring, it gave it a boost. And I wanted to pick up one of the things that you said, Morten, that the Arab Spring caused a brotherhood of discontent that could be utilized to legitimate violence against real and perceived wrongdoers, those responsible for a world of injustice. Now, if we look at what has happened in the Arab world, let's say the broader Arab world, but also some of the other countries that have been influenced by these popular uprisings, what we see 10 years later is not really a sea of change. It is perhaps Tunisia that made the transition, and of course the difference between one and zero is extensive, but still there are a lot of root causes in the Middle East that are much more precarious today, even before the coronavirus, but with the coronavirus, into situations of armed conflict and mismanagement, poor state-driven authoritarian states that have been able to strengthen their instruments. And we know from the history that violence will not lay these ideologies and these movements to rest. They will give them recruiting or breeding ground to some extent. So looking at this picture of where we are 10 years later is gloomy, in my view. Where are the lights in the tunnel? What do we see going forward? because these movements, they breed when the state apparatus is weak. Do we agree on this, or is it too simplistic?
I think it's not simplistic, but it's a dilemma, right? Because, as you say, authoritarian states breed movements such as these, right? That's one of the root causes, you know, the fight against the Egyptian regime is kind of was the birth, you know, of much of what we are seeing. But at the same time, as I said earlier, these movements are also exploiting democracy and states in transition, right? So, in the case of Tunisia, right, when the authoritarian regime fell and the state apparatus became weak, jihadists exploited this situation and formed, you know, the biggest foreign fighter contingent going to Syria. So another interesting case is Jordan, right, which has gone clear of at least launched attacks, but they have managed to stop much of the violence, and they have used what me and my colleague Henrik Grotrud have coined a calibrated approach, which means it's not you know, combining hard and soft measures and balancing because if you don't have hard counterterrorism approach against the hardest factions of this movement, they will just continue and grow and become stronger, right? But if you only use the hard or the fist and not combine it with the soft approaches, which is one of the things Jordan has done, I think a lot of right in terms of doing, you will also have a problem.
So, winning the hearts and minds, the ABC of insurgency.
The ABC of insurgency, right? No, I mean, I, if you look at the Middle East now, because let's stay in the Middle East for at least a little while. 10 years after the Arab Spring, I mean, and as you rightly point out, Cecilia, I mean, it looks gloomy. It seems like it's ready for something. The question is, something is going to crack here, but what is going to crack? And I think there are sort of trends that are going in opposite direction here, because one is that, I mean, the idea of the caliphate is not dead. The idea of ISIL Daesh is not dead. I mean, there are Al-Qaeda franchises that are still operating. This whole idea about jihadi Salafism is still there. But there are also opposite trends. I mean, like, for example, I mean, the huge demonstrations in Lebanon against mismanagement that, in a way, united across sectarian boundaries. We have seen some of the same tendencies in Iraq as well, in some of these demonstrations against state mismanagement, against unemployment and so on, where people from different, from the Communist Party of Iraq to various Shia clerics to whatnot were involved in some of these demonstrations. So, I mean, there are opposite trends there, and what will come out on top of this is difficult to say, but something will come on top of it. If not, the regimes in the region are able to increase the quality of government, and not only increase the quality of government so that it looks nice on World Bank sheet papers on economic growth or something like that, but manage to do something with unemployment, youth that basically has given up, and making certain that their countries become more positioned for merit rather than connections.
But these were exactly the same issues that we discussed in the 2000s, just prior to the uprisings and the Arab Spring. And we thought that this could be the moment where that shift happened. It didn't.
It wasn't, but it doesn't mean that it's not valid still to discuss this, because these, it's this exactly the same underlying issues that are present today in the region.
And this is my next question, because there are changes happening in the region. The Gulf states, for instance, which, if we talk about Salafism, this is the birth and the heart and the driving force of Salafism. Things are happening in the Gulf right now with new rulers, with an end to the era of the petroleum richness and a need to build these states on a different foundation. And this is also perhaps affecting these more profound issues. There are also things happening in Egypt and in Turkey, meaning the great countries that that are the largest Sunni Muslim countries, at least in the Middle East. Now, if you have these changes and they change the way they interact with the Salafi environments, you would think that that has an impact, perhaps not in the short term, but would it have an impact in the long term, do you think? And I can start with you, Mark. And I would like all of you to answer that question.
Well, I mean, there are so many sort of layers of changes now going on, both in the wider world, but also in the Middle East, that will have an impact. But again, I mean, whatever comes up on top here, yes, I mean, I agree with you, Cecilia. I mean, there are some new strategic thinking in some of the Gulf states, because there is a new generation of leaders that are emerging, for good or for bad, perhaps. That remains on how you see them and how you see the various things that they are doing and how they are trying to both monopolize but also to capture state power in many ways. And if some of these new entrepreneurs, if you can call them that, are able to initiate some sort of economic change, because that is needed in order to preserve their own elite status, basically, that may have bearings further down in society that may change part of it. But again, it depends on whoever sort of wins this game and are able, and if they are able to oversee such a transition without losing power themselves. And then you have that the greater game of sort of power in the Middle East between these Sunni states, I mean, where you have sort of Turkey on one side and Egypt, Saudi Arabia on the other side. So you have that fight going on. And then you have an Iran that also intervenes in all of this. So we have that on the top level of this. And underneath there, you have this simmering discontent. I mean, this brotherhood of discontent that I talked about, and whoever will be able to capitalize on that, will that be one of these new rulers? Will it be some of the jihadi forces? Or will some of these new, more social forces that has a slightly more sort of secular, anti-sectarian drive that we have seen in Lebanon, that we have seen in Beirut, in Baghdad at least partly, will they be able to sort of ride this new wave further? And I mean, right now we have far more questions than we have answers.
Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, I agree to some extent. We are really in a period of transition, with new geopolitical settings. Some great powers moving out of the region, some great powers moving into the region. You have the reinstated or authoritarian regimes, but authoritarianism does not necessarily mean that will not necessarily be fuel to jihadism. Right? It depends on many factors, and I don't see it that we go here. There is not a one way road to you know, more and more jihadism that it will grow into heaven. You know, it all depends on a lot of economic factors, such as Martin said, and how these authoritarian regimes frame kind of their new policies. And we have also a secularist movement starting to become more visible in the region. And we have a youth bulge of you know, young people who are of the social media age, And there are some things we can't really predict, and that's the zeitgeist, you know, how the new generation interpret the new world, right? And that will have a lot to say for the extent to which jihadists manage to appeal, you know, to be able to recruit and sustain the movement for 10 more years. Although if you look at the parameters that we usually do in our work, is like the number of attacks and foil plots and organizations and new areas of operation and so forth, things look quite gloomy. We can't predict really.
When you are in the middle of the night, it looks gloomy until you see the sun coming up. Now, just one question before we move on to Vidar, because in your presentation, you also talked about this link between what is happening in the Middle East and what is happening in these networks. So just a precision, if things change in the Middle East, do you think that will also change what goes on in these networks in Europe?
As I emphasized, I think what we as Western nations are doing in the Middle East has that will impact on of course the threat levels internationally. The things internal politics in Middle Eastern countries will of course have something to say for future recruitment. But I mean, that's a much more intricate problem. But the main thing is that, you know, Western nations and the US gradually moving out of the region may have some impacts. I don't think that unfortunately we will see no threat or decreasing threat levels. There will be some elevated threat levels in at least in Europe for the foreseeable future. But I don't think we will see like waves of attacks that came out of the situation in Syria and the rise of IS.
So, Vidar, how does this look in Africa, do you think? If you have change in the Middle East, also at a doctrinal level, how will this affect the development in Sahel? Will it affect it at all, or will it have an effect after some time?
I think I will perhaps continue on the gloomy path that Petal was on. I'm not very optimistic, and I think we shouldn't underestimate how quickly the changes are. I don't think many people had envisaged that you'd have a caliphate in Syria and Iraq just a few years before it happened, and I think that's the case for places in Africa as well. If you look at Burkina Faso, for instance, like a lot of people regarded that as kind of the island of stability in like in this troubled region in 2014 and 2015 when things were still secure in Burkina Faso, but they were ramping up in Mali. And then suddenly you had a revolution, and then the insurgency started. So the things can happen very quickly. In Burkina Faso, and I think, as Morten mentioned, with Mozambique, for instance, things can spring up quite quickly. And I think with what happened in Mozambique, I mean, people were at first very much doubting whether or not this was actually an IS faction. And the same is happening in Congo, by the way, that suddenly you have quite an active IS faction popping up in a completely new area. And I think there are other places in Africa that also have some of the same structural problems that can allow for this to continue. I'd say regardless of what happens in the Middle East.
Now, 10 years ago, the French anthropologist Scott Latran, he said concerning violent extremist jihadists, that never in the history of mankind has so few with so little means scared so many. Now, 10 years on, is that still what we can say, because when we look at the world today, we have a lot of security challenges. There are many. Now, why is this one of the things that we should fear? And I would want you to have a comment on this from your respective fields. I will start with you.
Thank you. Why should we fear this? We should.
Or should we fear it?
Rather? We should be worried about it, because what, at least in the you are very correct, Cecilia, that there are a number of threats that we should, that we need to worry about, that we need to be concerned about. And what this adds to regions that are relatively close to Europe is an additional layer of insecurity, violence and uncertainty that comes on top of so much else. I mean, I'm currently now trying to finish a book on the Sahel, which I call Sahel, the Perfect Storm. And there is a perfect storm looming here, where the jihadi component is just one component of that storm, but it's an important component, and it comes on the top of these other factors, an enormous youth bulge and really a population explosion in some of the most weakest fragile states in the world that are seeing a doubling of their populations. An economy that is completely unable, as it's situated right now, to deal with this population growth. And then add that you have, these are the areas of the world, and this includes also the Middle East, in fact, that will be affected the most severely by the climate changes that are coming. You have something that looks like a perfect storm. And if you then put the jihadi insurgencies on top of this, well, we have a problem. And it's a problem that needs to be dealt with both as a whole, but one also needs a combination of hard and soft measures. One needs a combination of pragmatism and steadfastness. And one needs to sort of figure out other parts of these groups that we can deal with through negotiations. And that, in that regard, the Sahel is emerging as some sort of an exception. Because we now have seen rounds of successful negotiations, not on sort of the larger compromises of peace, peace and conflict and these kind of things, but just after the coup in Mali, there was conducted successful negotiations with Jenim that led to the release of several international hostages and one important Malian hostage, a presidential candidate. And in return, they got released around 200 fighters. And that has built some sort of trust between these parties. There are now emerging news about secret negotiations in Burkina Faso. And there is an interesting new political platform emerging in Mali that may be transferable to other places, where you see some sort of an amalgamation of relatively socially conservative imams, but which also have some sort of a lack of a better word, some sort of a justice agenda that at least resembles the Muslim Brotherhood agenda, that are able to team up with more secular political parties in order to have a sustained push towards negotiations with the insurgents that they say are both local and that one can negotiate with. So they're striking a clear sort of division line here. They don't want to negotiate with Akim, for example, because they say they're foreign. They don't want to negotiate with the Islamic State Greater Sahara, but they do want to negotiate with parts of Jenim. And there is something interesting that is happening here that may enable one to take away at least one of these layers of uncertainty. And that is what violent jihadism represent. It adds an other layer of uncertainty and violence to an already worrying situation.
Just to add up on that, in the situation in Yemen, the hunger resulting from the economic war introduced from 2016 was not so bad in Al-Qaeda areas because of the smuggling routes of the jihadi movements were so effective, while the other areas did not have that. So it basically turned out to be to the advantage of the jihadists. But it has to do, again, with this ability to provide some services when the storm is going on. So we move to Europe.
Yeah, to Europe, I would say internationally. I really think we should be worried still about this movement and the future of this movement. And it's mainly because it's more transnational than we would like it to be. It would have been easier if it was more local, because then, you know, there's room for negotiations, compromises. There's better opportunities for mitigating. When we have this transnational network of nodes around the world, with and this flexibility, this mobility, this pragmatism, it just makes countermeasures very hard, right? That's what worries me the most. And we have, you know, there were very, very few people with few resources. Now there are many more people with many more resources than these people ever had, right? And also the history, you know, this is now a grown up movement, when you look at how these different factions or divisions of Al-Qaeda and IS popped up around the world in Africa, in Asia, in Europe, you see that they are historically connected. So one generation kind of socializes a new generation, which socializes and trains the third generation, and that is one of the most worrying things, I think, that this movement has become so persistent, shows this ability to appeal to people across different cultures, even though, of course, it's a fundamentalist Islamic movement. It also appeals to, you know, people from different cultures as well. It's not only transnational; it's also multinational, right? So I do think. But on the other side, of course, although the movement has lived for many years, we have also there's also some lessons learned in how to mitigate and how to tackle the threat, and that so that also plays into the picture when we are trying to predict the future. This is the X factor. What does the prevention policy mean for the future of the movement? We don't really know, because it's hard to measure, right? But a lot of things have been learned. We have learned about how dangerous, about how problematic it could be if too many foreign fighters are allowed to move around, right? We know more about that, so we have introduced new measures to prevent foreign fighting, and also we know much more about the how they use social media. So there are measures put in place to try to mitigate that, and so forth.
Yeah, I think I'll end on the doom and gloom again. I mean, we've learned a lot, but I mean, jihadists also adapt. As we've seen, to go back to the Sahel again. I mean, the fact that they're not holding territory now, for instance, that they're waging these more low-level insurgencies, is a direct consequence to what is happening. And they're very conscious of this. I mean, the leaders say themselves that we know that when the French came, we tried to. This is what I claim, at least. This is part of our strategy. We tried to spread the battlefield as much as possible, so we had to spread from northern Mali to all these other places to make it difficult for the French, because so they say, we know that we can outlast the French, the French are not going to stay there and secure the region for 10, 20, 30 years. But they will. That's what they say, at least. So that's a strategy, and that's kind of the X factor to see how long they can keep. To see if they actually can carry out this project that they say they will, with this being a generational fight. Just back to what Morten said with the negotiations. I mean, definitely some interesting things happening now, but I tend to be more a bit less optimistic about the prospects of this actually solving the bigger issue. There were similar talks of negotiations with the local actors in Northern Mali in 2012-2013. They're saying that they would negotiate with Ansar al-Din and not the AQIM and the other foreigners. And there were negotiations, and it looked like they were beginning to get some concessions, but. But what usually happens then is that the hardliners break out and continue fighting. Yadav Ali, who leads JNIM now, I'd say represented the group that was more less interested in negotiating in 2013. So I think we should be, even though these negotiations can lead to temporary ceasefires, for instance, I think we should be very skeptical about the prospect of actually negotiations leading to a more lasting peace.
Okay, now on a final note before we end, the Syrian playwright Sadallah Wanous said, "We are condemned to hope." And this is a Yatta conference, and the NATO alliance had its only Article 5 operation following an attack on the US by Al-Qaeda. And that led to the operations in Afghanistan, subsequently in Iraq, to operations in the Mediterranean, and so forth. Now, judging from what you have said today, my question to you is, how do you see the role of NATO going forward, working on this threat? Because this is not an easy, solvable threat with the instruments that the alliance has at its disposal, because it happens primarily very far from the area of responsibility. So how do you see NATO having a role going forward? And I would like a final comment from all.
I can start. No, I mean, we have seen what NATO can do in this regard. We saw it in Libya, and it's been a disaster. So I think that if to avoid replicating further Libyas around the world, the best thing would be that NATO was set up as a conventional organization for conventional security to prevent conventional warfare between the Western world and the Soviet Union, and it should remain locked into that paradigm, taking NATO in deep into counter-terrorism operations, be it in the Middle East or elsewhere in the world. I think would create more disasters than it would do good, in my point of view. We have enough trouble with Barkhane and the French operation Barkhane and others involved. Not to say that Barkhane is doing anything wrong. The problem with Barkhane is basically that it raised a lot of promises that Barkhane and France actually cannot fulfill, and that is creating a lot of resentment locally. I mean, we have interviewed a number of local communities in the Sahel, both in Mali and Niger, and their main sticking point against Barkhane is not that Barkhane is in their area. Their sticking point and what makes them angry is that Barkhane is not in their area in order to protect them, because they thought that when Serval and Barkhane was initiated, that it would come and protect them. And France is not able to do that. And I don't think that any other external actors either have the capacity and willingness to stay and protect in the Sahel. So yes, we should not be naive. We need military measures against these forces, but we need to find better ways of combining hard and soft measures, and we need to be extremely pragmatic if we are to find a way out of the current mess in this regard, both in the Middle East and in the Sahel. And I don't see a major role for NATO there. Rather, on the contrary, NATO should stick to what NATO can and should not try to learn new tricks.
I think NATO will and perhaps should continue to play a role in military interventions of some because I think it will be necessary because new proto-states will pop up, unfortunately. Of course, the issue here is to calibrate, as Morten refers to find the kind of right amount of resources that you put into it, and combine, you know, combine heart and minds and hard measures, because I think that has been the problem all along, that the military measures against jihadism has you know been too much, too fast, or too soon, and it resulted in very lengthy operations. So going on forward, I think one should, you know, use the intelligence and what we have learned about jihadism to try and kind of calibrate the measures better.
I also think NATO will have a role to play. But it remains to be seen. It remains to be seen how much effort NATO is willing to put into these issues. I mean, first at a time when you see like growing competition between China and the West, for instance, I think maybe there will be people will be less willing or to invest huge resources in taking down jihadist proto-states in Africa, for instance. So I think that might play into it, and people are afraid of being stuck in the Iraqi swamp or the Sahelian swamp for years and years and years.
But can I pick up that as a one last question? Because if NATO doesn't do it, because it has other priorities, and rightfully so, Europe will face the effects of what happens in the Sahel and in the Middle East. It is our neighbor geographically and otherwise, so this will affect Europe deeply, no matter what China and the US, Russia and NATO decides to do. So then, is this a European problem?
To a certain extent it is, and at least if you look at North Africa and the Sahel, I mean, particularly the Sahel. I mean, the US didn't care much about this area under Obama. That didn't change under Trump, and I don't think it's going to change under Biden either. So this will be, and at least North Africa and the Sahel will remain a European concern, and Europe and the EU and non-EU countries like Norway needs to find better approaches to how to deal with what is common challenge for all of Europe, but we need to do that in such a way that we do not end up with replicating extremely heavy-handed military measures that only pushes more people towards jihadi factions. And that's the challenge. And I have for a long time argued that the EU together with the UN should recalibrate its whole military approach in the Sahel towards basically stopping a relatively futile hunt for people we call terrorists in the sand dunes of the Sahel Sahara, and rather focus on giving people as much protection as possible and working together with local communities, because that for me is the solution. Increase human protection rather than trying to run after people we call terrorists. Of course, we need hard measures against some of these. So I'm not naive, I'm relatively realist when it comes to these kind of things. We need to use violence as well, but we need to become much better at calibrating the violence and making certain that we protect local development initiatives, because that's the only way out of it.
And then one more question, adding up to you, because one of the actors with the most powerful leverage in the Middle East today, at least if we stick to the Middle East, is Russia. So if you want to stabilize the Middle East, who should you cooperate with? And Russia is one of those actors with quite a lot of leverage. So how should Europe approach this issue? Because this is, of course, a more challenging perspective. Now, picking up on what you said, you need to calibrate the use of force. And that is one issue. Now, the second issue is, how do you work with the local states as an external? You need to do this with the local states, trying to strengthening their control and their legitimacy. So again, this is, and with the European history, Europe goes into these regions with power, meaning military power or economic leverage. They will be met with history. So what are the effective measures that the Europeans can use in order to try to bring this into an endpoint, so to speak, that is different from that gloomy picture that I'm afraid that we have been presenting here today, despite my efforts to try to take it towards a brighter morning? What can Europe do in a kind of a final round from you two?
Well, as I think I have to agree with Vidar also that neither NATO or the EU has any appetite for, you know, being drawn into conflicts in this area. But as I said earlier, I think we at some point will be forced to do something. And then there is the question, who has the capacity? And capacities within the military capacity within of the EU as a union is of course very limited to mostly peace operation. And then you have the individual countries and their policies are of course shaped by their history also in the region. So if you look at what France could are doing and could be doing in the future, and also the UK and countries that have traditionally been relatively reluctant to, at least in newer times, like Germany, to contribute. But I think situations will happen that will force some kind of action in the region. I don't know I don't want to predict anything about how they should cooperate with the new actors that are operating in the region, such as Russia and to also China, of course. I'll leave that to Vidar.
Well, thanks, Petter. I'll see. When it comes to Russia and China, I'd say let's wait and see until the next big crisis comes. I'd just like to comment on the European perspective. This is clearly something. I think this is going to be more important. And if you look at France's presence in the Sahel, for instance, they worked very hard now to get more European states aboard. This is not only a French issue; it's a European issue, and some states have already started responding to this. So they are trying to deployed a new force that that supports Barkhane that comes from a number of European countries, with such as you can fill me in on this, Sweden, Estonia, a couple of other countries. So there are some initiatives at least to draw more European countries into security cooperation here, and that is probably going to be more important in the years to come.
So on that positive note, we will round up this discussion. It has been a gloomy conversation, but as I said, in the middle of the night, it is very dark, and that is just before you see the sunrise. So thank you very much, and I leave the word.